Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
Hello, Smart Money Tree Podcast listeners. Welcome to this week's show. My name is Kurt Chisholm, and I will be your host. So today, we're joined with Ben Summers. How are you doing today, Ben?
Doing well. Good to see you, Kurt.
Yeah, glad to have you in the show. Well, Ben, love to have you tell the listeners a little bit about your background. I think the listeners are going to find this interview really fun. Our pre-interview was certainly fun. So tell the listeners a little bit about your background.
My academic background is in physics. I've evolved into running an investment bank that's focused on quant-based efforts. That effort was very much non-traditional, right? So most people will come through their Ivy League MBA, run through their internship at one of the bulge bracket firms, then go out on their own. I actually didn't, right? After that baseball career came to an end, moved into oil and gas for a period that was anti-intellectual, very fraternal, long story short, got out of that. And then moved into real estate investing because that was an entrepreneurial venture that allowed for leverage, didn't require a great deal of startup capital because of the opportunities for leverage, particularly in this time around 2005. It didn't take me very long though to realize there are a lot of people looking for very few good deals. And so instead of trying to butt my head against a wall, and given my technical background, my solution was an evolution in complexity. So went from looking for good deals to acquire, really couldn't find them, rotated into hard money lending, asset-based lending, developed a model that was insulated from the market crisis of 2008 by virtue of valuing assets as a function of their income and not comparable sales. Did really well, created a fund around that, and ultimately evolved into an investment bank that on the buy side, recruits asset managers who can generate objectively better risk-adjusted performance than what's otherwise available to traditional markets as measured by all four statistical moments, mean, variance, skewness, and kurtosis across a minimum of one complete market cycle. Because if you do not know what your performance looks like across a market bottom, you know nothing about your risk exposure. So on the buy side, we recruit those guys. Then we apply our financial engineering expertise to engineer products that bridge the gap between the capital terms that would naturally issue and the capital market appetite. So that's an extremely abbreviated sort of evolution of where we are now and how we got here.
Cool. Well, let's dive in because I think you talked about a lot of terms that are probably going to throw people for a little bit of a loop. So you recruit asset managers for the best risk-adjusted returns. Let's talk about risk-adjusted returns. What does that mean and how do you look at that?
That is the linchpin of all investing. And that gets lost in all of the propaganda heuristics. And there are only three things that matter in investing. And this is an objective fact. It's not opinion. It is risk, return, and liquidity. That's it. Any other considerations are simply a means to qualify what an asset or portfolio might look like because you really don't know what you're doing. And this is what pervades the entire game of analysis, particularly on the retail side. So the first question is, what is risk? If you ask 999 out of 1,000 financial professionals, what is risk? They will give you the Brook Trout look. They've got no idea. They'll talk around it. They'll talk about variables that contribute to risk, but they can't define it. And supposedly, these guys are supposed to be the curators of investments. Your fiduciaries who are taking care and making sure that your savings is safe. Here's the definition. Risk is the probability of loss weighted by the expected degree of that loss. And this is evidenced in very simple gambles. Think about a football board. How is a square priced? It's priced by the pot and the number of squares. What's the probability that I'm going to win? What's the pot when I win it? The simple relationship between those two numbers will tell you what each square is worth. That's the break-even point. That's it. Now, the mathematics, as Nassim Taleb refers to, these are ludic games that follow a Gaussian distribution. So gambling in a casino, for example, very constrained, very simple mathematics, relatively speaking, to analyze. Now, investing is way more complex. In the 1960s, Mandelbrot put out there and effectively proved that investments, markets, do not follow a Gaussian distribution. What's a Gaussian distribution? It's a bell curve, right? Where everything falls in a normal, gently sloping distribution, where the tail risk, the probability of extreme events occurring is very low. And you know what that is. Well, what Mandelbrot showed is that investments and markets follow what are called Levy distributions, where the variance is infinite. So what that means is, qualitative terms, is that the probability of a really bad thing happening is much higher than people expect. And the effects are typically much worse than people plan for. So you have to account for this. Now, The way you do it is relatively straightforward. I guess as a quick aside, people generally, quantitative finance is kind of relegated as just a sidecar kind of one of many perspectives kind of thing. And that's due to the fact that it evolved through modern portfolio theory, where risk was defined as standard deviation. I don't want to go too technical here, but long story short is that's wrong. And the reason that's wrong is because risk is only equal to standard deviation if the markets or investments follow a bell curve. They don't. So in 2001, modern portfolio theory evolved. We got even a little sooner than that. We entered what was called postmodern portfolio theory, where risk became more accurately measured. Keating and Chadwick in 2001 developed the Omega ratio, which is a function of integrals, very hard to deal with discrete data sets in that regard. But in 2014, a guy named Capsos evolved the Omega ratio into a function of expected returns. What's expected return? Quick aside, talking about risk, return, and liquidity. Right now, we're talking about risk. Well, what's return? Return is simply the average of historical performance, again, across a minimum of one complete market cycle. Now, when I say average, there are a couple of different ways of computing average. There's the common way, which is arithmetic mean, where you just take a bunch of numbers, you add them together, you divide by the number of numbers. Well, you need to look at what's called geometric mean, where it's an exponential function. Not going to dive into that. It's a different way of computing average. It's the way you have to do it. And the reason you have to do it that way is because, for example, a 50% loss and a 50% gain are not the same thing. If you have $100 and you lose 50%, you've got $50. If you gain 50% of the $100, you're 75, not 100. So a 50% loss and a 50% gain are not equal. And the way you account for that is with geometric mean, not arithmetic. So that's, again, getting a little bit into the weeds.
Actually, I think that's actually an important concept too. I want to just kind of pull it out for a second. A lot of Wall Street uses arithmetic means as a way to boost their numbers as opposed to geometric. And it's just one of those games of Wall Street. It's like a half truth that people play and because they can. I mean, you see this all the time.
Sure. The games that are pulled through traditional finance, particularly retail finance, are just egregious. And the analogy that I draw is that, and I'm going to upset a lot of people, that's okay. The typical financial advisor is no different than a car salesman at a dealership. The only difference really is that they've got a license and a little bit more polish, better vernacular. But at the end of the day,
sometimes
they have been indoctrinated by their manufacturers, which are the bulge bracket firms, to believe that whatever they're selling is the best. And they believe it because that's what they've been indoctrinated to believe through the culture of the system through which they operate. So in most instances, a financial advisor is hardly one step above their client in terms of expertise, and often less, which is why a lot of clients just perceive their advisor as a conduit to a clearinghouse. They're not viewed typically in the same level of respect as, say, a cardiologist would be. And there's a reason for that. So to your point, the conflation of arithmetic and geometric mean, and again, not needing to prove the mathematics, but just that conversation is obfuscated for less than noble reasons. And you'll find almost everything you hear through a traditional advisor about traditional markets is flawed. Here's one example. It's safe to say that most people believe that risk and return are conserved, which means that, well, the higher the return I want to achieve, the more risk I inevitably have to incur. That is true within efficient markets. That's expressed mathematically by virtue of that expected return is generally at best equal to standard deviation, which is generally at best approximately equal to maximum drawdown. So yeah, if you're dealing in efficient markets, then risk and return are conserved. But there's a bigger world. And this is where we mentioned, I talked about a little bit before we got fired up here, was that tribalism pervades investing and finance. FINRA people are champion publicly traded assets. Real estate people champion real estate, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So let me provide you an example of where risk and return are disconnected. A very simple example that I was involved in over a decade ago, which is asset-based lending. At that time, particularly like 2009, 2010, when liquidity was relatively scarce, you could lend against real estate with an 18% interest rate. That was generally the usury limit in most jurisdictions, right? So you're lending an 18% fixed income instrument, by the way, with a 50% equity cushion, right? So you're lending at 60, 65% LTV, 100% times 0.65 is 65%. But what's 65 times 1.65, right? You get closer to 100. It's not symmetric in that regard. You're looking at about a 50% equity cushion, which means, by the way, residential markets on the national average fell 27% between 2007 and 2011. So over a 4-year plus period, residential markets fell 25%. Well, I had a 35% equity cushion and I was making 18% returns. So we didn't lose because we had responsible leverage. We used responsible value. So my point is that if you run the quantitative analysis and the performance of that strategy, the returns and the risk are nowhere close. They're completely disconnected. But if you say something like that to a traditional financial professional that, hey, I want to pursue a high yield investment that's got very low risk, they will look you straight in the eye and say that doesn't exist.
You raise a great point. There's one of those half truths of risk and return, and also the fact that financial advisors, not just financial advisors, like institutions, supposed experts don't really understand the difference. They think that risk is basically diversification and they don't understand risk beyond that. I am a little bit curious. You know, I want to hear some of the other kind of half truths that you see all the time. I guess the disconnect between the retail public and the institutional side is enormous. And I think one of the things I would just love to hear kind of some of the other examples of that.
It's much deeper than you probably even, or at least most listeners probably even would expect. Because even on the institutional side, you have what I would describe as non-technical management calling the shots. So people like myself, the Michael Burrys of the world, we are exceedingly rare. And when you're operating in the context of a bulge bracket firm, you are generally relegated to the proverbial basement to provide a perspective that management can manipulate any way they see fit. So for example, in 2008, you saw management genuinely shocked that their banks were now insolvent. The quants knew it. They just ignored them because they didn't want to hear it. So it's far worse than people expect. You've got indoctrinated retail army of pawns that are is financial advisory. But even on the institutional side, the overwhelming majority of the management and staff are relatively non-technical people that are just following heuristics of the industry and drinking at the same bowl of Kool-Aid as everybody else. The critical thinking is just a kernel within the bulge bracket firms, and it's utilized at best as a consulting service that allows the bulge bracket firms to bet against the public. And this was on full display in the Senate hearings post-2008.
You mentioned just a little while ago about how 2008, 2011 was a great time to basically invest in hard money, which I agree. We probably had the most amount of volume through that period of time just because we didn't have enough clients with cash to fill all of the possibilities out there. But, you know, I think one of the challenges of hard money is it's the timing. That was a great situation, but the last few years has been terrible for that just because of the prices and all the things. It's the other side of the coin. So you're talking about a full market cycle. So talk through that with like something like hard money of how you look at that during a full cycle.
I hear that question framed in the context of a real estate silo. So it is true that interest rates and hard money have been compressed over the last decade, but hard money lenders are still generating double-digit yield on relatively low LTV, highly collateralized notes. What's the publicly traded counterpart look like? It's negative real yield. So still on a relative basis, private credit, asset-based lending against responsibly collateralized assets that's effectively managed is not even close. It's exponentially better than what's otherwise available to traditional markets. So you're describing it relative to the peak of the real estate opportunity. But you have to look at it not in the context of one asset class, but across all asset classes. If you look today, if you're asset class agnostic, dish and tribalism, and you look at private fixed income instruments that are available, even with the Fed balking at substantial rate increases, what's better? People, I know, think in terms of word clouds. They don't necessarily listen to what sentence construction actually is designed to intend. But so what I'm telling you here is that I am not a champion of hard money lending. I'm using it as a super simple example that most people can relate to. Like, we didn't do it like most hard money lenders do. And I'm not going to provide a masterclass on reverse repo lending in the real estate space. But my point is that it's not about how does this opportunity compare against other periods within the same asset class. It's looking not vertically, temporally, but horizontally amongst everything that's available today. How does that strategy compare? And I'd still argue it's overwhelmingly better than almost everything else, including equity. Remember, you're looking at a fixed income product with double-digit returns. The geometric mean of S&P performance is less than 9% historically. So you're doing better than equity yield with a fixed income product. Oh, by the way, liquidity. So let me finish the thought on risk, return, liquidity. This is the thrust of everything. I'll try to pull back a little bit and get a little less technical on the risk side. So long story short, Risk, the probability of loss weighted by the expected degree of that loss, can also be measured. For those who do have a technical inclination, it's the denominator of the Capsos form of the omega ratio. So anyway, now we've measured return, the geometric mean of historical performance across at least 15 years, ideally as many as you can get. Now we've measured risk in accurate terms that accounts for infinite variance. And the third is liquidity. And this is what brought me back to the risk return liquidity conversation, is that question. Particularly financial advisors, champions of equities, argue for the liquidity of public markets. I argue that the real operational definition of liquidity is this. It's not, can I intraday trade? It's, I'm investing for an expected return. Under the worst case scenario, how long will it take to realize that expected return? That is a practical operational definition of liquidity quality. And the answer to that is this. So there's a well-established metric in quantitative finance called maximum drawdown duration. It's not even really an expression. It's almost like a graphical measure where you're just looking, what is the time frame peak to peak in a chart? How long did it take to get back to zero? Well, to your point earlier about half-truths, who invests to get back to zero? You don't go on a roller coaster ride when you invest. If you want to get back to zero, you'd hold cash. So it's a more valuable measure to say, what is the maximum drawdown duration, not to get back to zero, but to realize the expected return, because that's what we're investing in this particular asset for. Now, if you look at the S&P 500 since 1984, take a guess. What is the maximum drawdown duration to achieve the expected return of the S&P if you started in 1984? 33 years. So in June 2007, Black Friday took a big hit. If you invested that day before, if you invested then, it would have taken until June 2020 to realize an 8.5% compounded gain. 33 years. That is the real liquidity characteristic of publicly traded assets. And by the way, if you look at everything publicly traded, just the nature of secondary markets, we won't go into why this might be the case, but beta is very high. What that means is the correlation of all publicly traded assets is very, very close to one. For example, the MSCI US REIT Index has a beta of about 0.85. By definition, the beta of the S&P is one. So they move in tandem. And FINRA will even tell you, you cannot diversify away market risk. So the point is that there is no refuge in private markets from that bullshit performance. Another way of looking at it is the expected return for most portfolios, about 8.5%, give or take, over the long term. The maximum drawdown, 50%. Your exposure on the downside is over 5x your expected gains. And financial advisors will look you in the eye and tell you that's safe. And that's the best you can do. So to summarize, doesn't matter where your identity or your beliefs or your affinities or your emotional defects push you. The only three variables that matter are risk, return, liquidity. They're all numbers and they can all be accurately measured. That's it. And so to responsibly allocate, no matter who you are, you want to know what those things are. And given what you have access to, you want the things that rank the best with those three fundamental measures. I think most retail investors get that intuitively. They may not be able to express it, but they intuitively get that. Whereas financial advisors, their eyes gloss over. What about diversification? So that's that.
I'm glad you kind of went into detail about those three things. So how would you go about integrating those three things into portfolios for people now that you've kind of explained conceptually, you know, what matters?
First, you need to dispel the notion that diversification for the sake of diversification is a good idea. I'm not a big fan of Warren Buffett, but he did say one thing that I appreciate, which is diversification is nothing more than insurance against ignorance. And so if you know what the quality of investments are, then you simply measure the risk, return, liquidity for what you have available. Or if you can't do it, your financial advisor should be able to. And if he can't, you need to find somebody who can. Now, this is not a pitch for me. We're not retail facing. I don't deal with retail clients. I'm not looking for you to come to me. But I am telling you that this is the conversation that needs to be had. Either you make the effort to learn how to measure risk, return, liquidity, or find a professional investment advisor who is able to, or at least willing to learn. And now what you'll find is that if you take that approach, your portfolio will have very limited exposure to public markets. If you have access to institutional grade stuff, right, the kind of stuff that we engineer, you'll find that you're going to be in a lot of illiquid assets. Now, one point I think maybe a lot of retail people don't understand, and even financial advisors tend to overlook, is that if you have a time horizon of less than 2 years, which means if you need your money back in less than 2 years to do something, you should not be invested in capital markets anyway. You should be in cash, cash equivalents, money market. So a lockup of 24 months, it's a moot point, because if you can't sustain a lockup of 2 years, you shouldn't be in capital markets anyway. I don't give a shit how liquid equities are, because it's not investing to put money in with a high probability of pulling less out when you need it. So the answer, it's not as straightforward as you might be hoping for here. And I think part of this is, again, if we were a retail facing firm, I'd say, well, here's the answer. Just come call us at 800-9. But we're not retail facing, so we don't have those solutions directly available. We are actually working right now on a pilot program to recruit a very small handful of RIAs who have the intellectual capacity to move with this intellectual merit-based approach. As you might imagine, it's a bit of a slog.
Yeah.
I think the first thing to do would be to simply acknowledge, be self-aware that, hey, risk, return, liquidity are the only really things that matter. And everything else I'm asking really is a circuitous, maybe counterproductive qualitative approach to trying to determine something that has already been established. Now, one more quick comment about that. And you'll hear a lot of people who don't know any better say, well, every investment document you're ever going to see, you're going to see something along the lines of past performance is not indicative of future result. So an analysis of the past doesn't guarantee future performance. And this is really an epistemological discussion and a statistics and probability discussion, almost a philosophy discussion. But I'll give you the take-home story here. It is true for any statistical analysis to be perfectly predictive, you must view an infinite number of data points across an infinite time period, which by definition is impossible. Then becomes a continuous function, et cetera. But I'll tell you this, if you have examined a minimum of one complete market cycle with a period that corresponds to the liquidity asset. So if you're looking at equities, you're looking at least monthly performance data. If you're looking at something with a longer lockup, at least annual performance data, you go back and you get at least 20 data points. Yes, there is certainly an opportunity for a black swan event to occur. A black swan event is something that falls outside the range of the previously experienced data. That can happen. So there is error inherent in statistical analysis. That being said, that error is diminutive compared to every other bullshit qualitative approach. It's like saying, well, in baseball, the bases are 90 feet apart. Are they really? At how many significant figures? There's error in everything. And so, yes, there's error in statistical analysis. The more data points you analyze across a longer horizon, the more accurate they become. And that is unequivocally, absolutely, matter-of-factly, the only responsible way to evaluate any investment or any portfolio, full stop. And one last bonus, black swan events. We even have the mathematical faculty to determine the probability of a black swan event occurring. So what is the chance that something in the future is going to happen that we've never seen before? This is a demonstrable statistical phenomenon. It is precisely equal to, relatively precisely equal to, 1 over the number of data points. So if you've looked at 100 historical data points, 100 months worth of historical data, we know with confidence that the chances of something being either better or worse than we've ever seen is 1 divided by 100, which equals 1%. So not only do we know the measure, but we effectively know the accuracy of that measure as well.
Let me ask you on that, because this kind of gets into the point about black swans, which black swans by nature are something that you didn't expect to happen. I'll give you a good example. 2020, you know, when COVID happened, and not the COVID thing, because you could call that a black swan. But what I'm referring to is, you know, if you think about at that period of time, there was a lot of information going around in the institutional world about the high yield bond market and the challenges that that faced at that time. And there were some good firms. Horizon Kinetics was doing a lot of research and pumping some out about this and a lot of the data points around that. And it was a well-known problem that this was going to be a black swan event. A bunch of firms would get downgraded. It's a fire hose going into a keyhole and it just wasn't going to work. And it would be a huge problem. So then the Fed stepped in and said, we're going to buy all the high yield bonds. They never did anything, but they said they did. So it just quelled the market. And that wasn't. So I guess my point is that black swan didn't happen because people knew about it. So how do you find black swans? If people know about them, they're not going to happen. It's this catch 22 in the whole process. So how do you kind of look at that?
This is a fundamental sort of paradigm shift. Most people try to predict the future. And I don't agree with everything that Nassim Taleb says, but I do agree with this. Trying to predict the future is a fool's errand. You can't. Only thing that you can responsibly do is look at the past across the worst case scenario we've ever seen and design your investment strategy, portfolio, or otherwise to be robust against that worst case scenario. The good news is 2008 was draconian. The inflation we saw across the 70s was awful. Now, can things get worse? Of course they can. But if you've designed your strategy to be robust against the inflationary 70s or the, in no uncertain terms, depressionary 2008 aftermath, then yeah, you could lose when another black swan event occurs. But on a relative basis, how well are you going to do compared to the people who don't even think about that or think in those terms? How many people put together pro formas that model 2008? It's an epistemological question. What people don't realize is when they try to make predictions about the future, when they're putting together pro formas, what they were doing intuitively without even realizing it is they're processing historical data in a non-rigorous way. But that's all they're doing. A pro forma is still an informal process of historical data. What I'm prescribing is a rigorous, optimized analysis of historical data, acknowledging that, of course, black swan events occur, but we know the probability of them occurring, and then knowing that you can lose, but on a relative basis, you're going to do exponentially better than everything else. Does that make sense?
Makes total sense. I 100% agree. We talk about a lot of those concepts on the show here. In the interest of time, I know we have to wrap it up in a few minutes, but I wanted to ask you, how do economic and market cycles come into your thinking as you're putting together investment strategies?
Precisely as I described, with the humility to state that I have no idea what the future is going to hold. And I'm aware of all the technical indicators that everybody else is, but I make a conscious decision to ignore them. And I say, it's my responsibility to design, to engineer an investment vehicle or an entire portfolio of engineered investment vehicles that are robust, if not anti-fragile, with respect to the worst cases we've ever seen, both in terms of inflationary and deflationary environments. And if you have done that, if you've looked at the world through that lens, the need to predict the future goes away.
Let me ask you the quick question, because you mentioned Nassim Taleb a few times, and this kind of comes into play with the fragile, anti-fragile, and robust. I know that what he does is he focuses on fragile and anti-fragile investments with his own self. I don't follow his stuff, but a lot of people say, let's just say it's subpar with the performance. So I guess I wonder, like, you know, looking at a guy like that who came up with a concept more or less, or at least wrote the book on it, and he's not able to do it successfully. So if it was that easy, I would imagine everybody would be doing it.
It's not easy, but it can be done. I'll explain how. So let me comment on Nassim Taleb's prescription, which is the barbell approach, which is 90% theoretically risk-free stuff, and then 10% aggressive, like VC type play. The problem with that is this. There's no such thing as risk-free. U.S. Treasuries have been downgraded for a decade. S&P, the most corrupt rating agency in the world, says that U.S. Treasuries aren't risk-free. And if you look at the balance sheet of the U.S., especially at the non-unfunded liabilities, that's not safe. A moron knows that currencies and the bond market are at risk. So there is no risk-free anything. On the high yield side, and he likes out-of-the-money puts, which theoretically are great, but counterparty risk is a thing in black swan events. What would have happened if you held out-of-the-money puts with Lehman Brothers as your counterparty in 2008? They're valueless. So again, I've got a tremendous amount of respect for Nassim Taleb, but as I prescribe, it's not about tribalism, Kool-Aid drinking, or blind following. You can pick good concepts and be objectively critical of others. In our case, the way we do it is we find asset managers who operate and trade unique arbitrage opportunities in private markets that are able to generate a disconnect in risk return by virtue of inefficiencies in information flows and inefficiencies in capital flows. A super simple example is hard money lending. On the other end of the spectrum, in terms of sophistication, would be synthetic risk transfer, where we're talking about securitizing a tranche in Fed member banks' balance sheets that was perfectly well insulated from the 2008 financial crisis and passed every Fed stress test thereafter with flying colors. So Fed member banks value liquidity at a premium. So after over a year plus of pursuing approval with the Federal Reserve Board, an asset manager we work with was able to get approval to securitize a tranche of Fed member banks' capital stack, buy it at a discount because they value the liquidity, and then sell it at market for a huge arbitrage. Things like this. It's not going to be buying the S&P or the NASDAQ. And so again, to be clear, the overwhelming majority of actively managed strategies, public or private, are objectively dog. I acknowledge that. Your mom and pop real estate syndicators, moron, don't buy it. But when you apply institutional rigor, institutional financial engineering skills to private markets, it's an entirely different ballgame. I colloquially call them designer financial products, that if you've got 100 million liquid, then you got access to that kind of stuff. And effectively, the public is the risk dump for these types of investments.
I appreciate you saying that, because I've been saying that for years. If you're buying something from big wirehouses because someone else is trying to sell it, it's not because it's a good deal. If it was a good deal, they give it the institutional clients first. Yeah, I appreciate that perspective. Well, Ben, I really appreciate you coming to the show. I know we got to wrap it up here. Some final thoughts from listeners, and where can people find more about you?
One final thought. You can think of me as a bit of an ideologue. Our competitors are BlackRock, Morgan Stanley, Goldman. Those guys win on brand name, and people know that they're and they'll still do business with them because the devil you know, so to speak. Well, in our case, we're not afforded a mulligan, and we're not going to win on brand recognition, Adagio Group. So we have to win on merit, which is why, not why, but that's the value proposition and the thesis that drives what we do, is taking the esoteric expertise that's used to bet against the public to create better financial products that create a win-win for everybody. So that being said, our website is adagio.capital. I wrote the book, The Shadow Banker's Secrets, Investment Banking for Alternatives, which describes the mechanics and non-technical terms for all the stuff that we described. You could find that at theshadowbankerssecrets.com. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
This is a public service announcement. Hi, my name's Kirk. I'm with the government, and I'm here to help. Doesn't that sound reassuring? Well, let's talk about how they're helping. The government needs your help to make our money worthless again. PPP loans, student loan forgiveness, helicopter money. Let's keep the party going until our money is totally worthless. Don't think it can happen? Sure it can. Just ask Zimbabwe, Venezuela, Greece, Germany, Hungary, Greece, Yugoslavia. Did I mention Greece? As a loyal listener to the show, I want to reward you with a gift. I want to give you free money. I'm giving away money from one of these six hyperinflationary currencies. Go to moneytreepodcast.com/free money and follow the instructions to get your free gift. I have a large audience and only a limited number of these currencies, so make sure you get yours before they run out. Go to moneytreepodcast.com/free money and get your free gift today.
Now we're into the panel portion of the show, where we have our very own Megan Gorman. Hey, Megan.
Hey, Kirk. It's good to see you.
Good to see you too. And we also have our very own Doug Hagren. Hey, Doug.
Good morning, Kirk. How are you doing today?
Doing wonderful. Megan, what were some of your takeaways from the interview?
I thought the interview was really, really interesting. I think that he did a very good job of defining things like risk and standard deviation and bell curve and sort of going through those concepts that often get glossed over in a lot of investment discussions. One of the things that he said that sort of stuck out at me really comes down to sort of how he talked about the education of advisors. And I sort of differed in my point of view on advisors all being sort of untrained and uneducated. So that was one the other thing that sort of stuck with me in the interview.
Doug, what about you? What are some of your takeaways?
Obviously, as a lot of people are who come on these panels that you do interviews with, they tend to have something, obviously, that's a focal point, something they're trying to sell from it. And so there's a little bit of that. Again, I think going what Megan said, I think that the topic of education and background and selection of advisor and understanding who's truly working, you know, towards your best interest and actually bringing something to the table that is really looking out for how to truly achieve. And, you know, and I think this word is watered down a lot, but holistic viewpoint for clients is something that really does need to be taken into consideration more than maybe some people do. Also, one of the things we've talked about, you know, before and in previous conversations, just amongst ourselves and in conversations we have, is the connection between emotion and how just, you know, the different ways. And I talk about this in college all the time, that the emotion versus the logic component. Unfortunately, in the area that I play, one of the areas I play in college planning, it is a tremendous influencer on the decisions that people made. And if you don't understand your own primitive, and it is primitive, we are at very functional, you know, basic level, we still have a lot of primitive things that control us. We are animals, right? So if we don't understand, and that's what makes us great as humans, the ability to be able to overcome and understand that. But if we don't work on that and don't see how that affects us, it unfortunately can drive us into decisions that aren't necessarily going to create the greatest outcome.
Hey, Doug, can I ask you a question? Because I know you specialize in education planning, and there are a lot of people out there who don't find, you know, don't get help on their planning until they're at that moment where they've got to start to really think about their kids and going to school. So if you're one of those parents out there and you're looking for a planner or an advisor, what are some of the questions you would ask in your search, like designations, experience? Like, what are some of the things you would tell them to look towards to find the right advisor who can help them plan for college?
That's a great question. There is some certifications out there, like certified college planning, although those are fairly controversial. I mean, because there's a lot of certifications out there that have popped up. I would say, you know, that is something to at least inquire. I'm not a certified college planner because I think it is an enhancement that says you've at least done some education and research into this world better than maybe someone that's not. I would ask questions about kind of who you've worked with, who you've helped, what kind of benefits you received, what are some of the ways that we can help my student position themselves for college better? What are the key areas that you see that are the biggest impacts on being able to not only get into colleges, but also give yourself an opportunity, the child the best opportunity to have an extraordinary outcome and experience while they're there and actually lead? What is the success rate of being able to, you know, when people follow and work with you, what is the success rate of being able to find colleges that is the right fit for the student? I always go back to academic, financial, and social, right? It's got to be schools that are going to provide the right academic path, but is also going to fit the student, the tribe. Students make the school. School doesn't make the student. You, when you get there, there's got to be a connection and an understanding kind of like what priorities families have, because everybody's different and there's a lot of, every campus is different. You have to understand again amongst yourself and your students, what is it that matters to you? And it's just like financial planning, right? It's not about, we talk about what's important versus necessary. What's necessary is having a 401k. Nobody on their deathbed said, God, I'm glad I had it. It's what's important is what you can do and why you're saving. Same thing with why you're going to go to college. And the last is financial. Who's going to give you the money? And ultimately, how successful they are in that. One of the first things I tell people is, do you help with the financial side of it too? And I talked to someone yesterday, like, you know, I keep finding I've got people who help me get my kids into school. And I got other that are financial advisors that'll help families, you know, help us pay for it. But I can't find anybody that does both. And that's one of the unique things we created because it wasn't out there. The service centers, the high school counselors, they don't typically have a background in college. You know, they're social workers first. Maybe there was a little bit of education on FAFSA. But ultimately, the high school counselors get just as excited and emotional about it. It's like, look how many kids we got going to Harvard. Well, yeah, but most of those kids, then they get there like $80,000 a year and they're taking all at least half of it in loans. So there's the conversation, like, how are you going to help me financially put a plan together to pay for it? A great question is, what's your process? What is the process that you have? And I think it's another thing that segues back to financial planning. It's, you know, I talk about this with families. There's the clubs versus the swing. The swing is learning how to play the sports. If we look at golf in financial planning approach, you got to learn how to play. You also got to have clubs. There's got to be clubs in place. You can't go out to the course and play 18 holes with just one club. And I think there's too much focus on this is a good product, this is a bad product. No, there's no such thing as a good or bad product. It's all, is it the right product for you? So you're going to have clubs in your bag to play the game. Some people, it might be a reverse mortgage. Terrible. No, but actually home equity conversion mortgages at 62 is basically, it's a HELOC. That's what it is. It's a guaranteed HELOC that I personally believe anybody at 62 should open up because you never have to pay on that. But it's like, oh, it's got such a bad name because people are selling it to him. No, it might be perfect for your situation. You know, a stock, a bond, permanent life, annuities. Okay, no such thing as good or bad. That's another thing. Commissions or fee, ha, talk about something that's been used for marketing. I think, yeah, everybody's got to have the clubs to play. Golf Galaxy guy is going to say, you know what, Big Bertha, guaranteed to take five strokes off your game. No, it's not. You got to go to the driving range and work on your swing first. And I think that comes down to process. What is your process? There's no such thing as a perfect process. There's no such thing as the best process because things change all the time. But is there a process? And I think, again, if there was one thing I'd ask anybody to say is, what is your process? What is your success rate? How do you help? And how do you combine getting my child into the right college and also paying for it? And do you do both sides? Because I think that's critical. And I think the biggest, the last thing is, if they talk about reach schools, fallback schools, target schools, that's like sitting there saying, you know, I've got a farm and I'm trying to raise dinosaurs. Listen, nobody should have a target school. I'm sorry, nobody should have a reach school. Nobody should have a fallback school. Why? Because if it's a reach school, it means you can barely get in. You're not going to stand out. You're ultimately going to be muddled in the pack. You're definitely not going to get financial aid from a merit standpoint, because you're kind of a nobody to the school because it's beyond who you are. And a fallback school, well, if a fallback school is on the list, it means your target schools were reach schools. End of story, right? Every school, you should have end up with a list of 6 to 10 schools, ideally, that fit academic, financial, social, logically. And by the way, that's the other thing. Major is nothing but a marketing thing. It's, oh, they have a major in this. That's what schools do to get you to come there. You got to look behind the curtains. What is it that that school does a really good job of? Do they have a good track? It's like, you know what? That school doesn't have an engineering degree. Well, I want to go to school with an engineering degree. Actually, they have a math major, but 85% to 90% of the math majors in that school go on to engineering schools successfully or get hired in big engineering firms. Wow. That's what you have to know behind that. So process. What is the process you follow? No different with financial planning, anything else. If there is a process philosophy behind it and a track record of doing it, that's a critical thing to ask and to learn about.
I really appreciate the fact that it sounds like it's a very well-rounded approach. I think one watch out I have for people about college education planning is I often hear people say, well, I work with an advisor, but they don't believe in 529 plans. And 529 plans, I think for most people, are a really good fit. But one of the reasons that's always my red flag getting into this is 529 plans can be either advisor sold or direct purchase. And I tend to veer on the direct side because then I don't believe the advisor should charge a fee on it.
There's nothing they can do on it. There's nothing. No, it's age-based. It's an advisory 529, right?
Right. Where I struggle is when an advisor says, I don't believe in 529s. You can overfund them. And the reason I say that is it makes me question the advisor's self-interest in it. Because then I start to see things again like UTMAs and UGMAs. And so I say this as a warning to people, which is on things like 529 plans, you should ask that question. Because if they say we don't believe in it or it's not the best idea, obviously ask why. But always remember 529 plans, you can get easy access to. You shouldn't pay advisor fees on. And a lot of other vehicles require you as the parent to pay taxes on. So UTMAs and UGMAs, you pay the taxes on for interest, dividends, and capital gains, where you get that benefit with 529s. So that's always sort of my red flag.
UTMAs and UGMAs are even worse, because if you're looking for need-based aid, they actually count as a student asset, where 529s count as a parent asset. That is almost a 50% weighting towards your expected family contribution. I like what you said there. Listen, and I have talked to people very candidly about 529s, but this goes back to the process and no such thing as good or bad. I talk about the different ways people can pay, things like cash flow, things like borrowing on your home, which is one of the biggest ways that some people pay for college, liquidating an account, which could include 529s, UTMAs, Roth IRAs, brokerage accounts. It could be using other things like annuities, life insurance, depends on it. Here's what it comes back to: discussing the process. What are the pros and cons? 529 plans, amazing tax strategy. It's no deduction going in, but it's tax-free going out. If you only got a couple of years—
Well, actually, it depends on the state. There are deductions in certain states. I just don't live in one.
Right. In Minnesota, we do. But you have to invest in a Minnesota in Minnesota, you can invest in any 529 anywhere. Colorado, you had to invest in their 529.
And by the way, Colorado has a crazy loophole tax-wise, because if you do the five-year funding, you get the huge tax deduction in that year. But of course, you have to put in like $160,000. So it's not practical for most people.
That is correct. Exactly. So you get into how much benefit you're actually, you know, and again, many states, it's kind of small. There are some states that have very sizable state tax deductions, you know, $10,000 plus. So you got to look at the tax situation, the affordability. Can you fund it? So there is a benefit there. The other side of it, though, is once they get into college, you have to liquidate the account. Well, for some people, when you're looking at their retirement situation, say if you're going to put all this money towards retirement, towards college, and then you're going to be a shortfall for retirement, is that going to be work for you? Because that money is going to be gone. You lose that money. You also lose the opportunity cost of whatever it could become. So if I spend $100,000 today over 30 years, I've now spent $300,000-$400,000 of future value. It's really important to look at a full financial plan of the impact of that. Because again, emotionally, I want to help my kid. but then they'll be helping you in 20, 30 years because you're not saving enough. So it goes back to that financial planning side of it. Another thing, again, I'll just for 529s specifically, and they've made some of the rules better. But again, for a lot of people, they just didn't have enough once they got there with the 529. So you still have enough, but then you end up still going into loans. Or you have extra, but you can't use the 529 to pay loans. They've changed that. Now you could pay $10,000 of loans. But then they changed it even further. Now you could give up to $30,000 away into a Roth IRA for a student if the 529 is 15 years old. I can tell you there's not a lot of parents have said, great, I want to give my kid 30 grand. Some kids might. There's also not a lot of people who have filled 529s for 15 years. And then if you're going into like freshman year of high school and you're going to need the money in 4 years, again, you might get the state tax deduction, but you're not really going to take a huge benefit of the 529 growth from a tax standpoint, because by the time they're that close, you can't be that aggressive anyway. So the upside isn't necessarily going to be much of a compound. As a matter of fact, general rule of thumb, if you need money within 5 years, it probably needs to be in cash. Well, then the 529 is not going to really give you much benefit. So now there becomes that multi-use accessibility. And another thing is 529s do count against expected family contribution. And they also, and this is not known to most people, can count against merit aid. Now, not on the surface, but we've seen lots of circumstances where colleges have given less merit aid than was expected, equal to the 529, because colleges view that as their money. So it's not a bad thing, but when you go through the different ways to pay, it's critical that you are having these conversations with these families to understand the pros and the cons. There's no such thing as a good product. There's no such thing as a bad product. What is the process? How do we look at it? What is your unique family situation need and what's going to apply? I have a case of a family that lost her job through $250,000 severance. I mean, they basically gave her years of it for it. And it was sitting in cash. They sold their house. So now they have all this money. They had like $700,000 sitting in checking. No income, living temporarily in their parents' house. And they've got a kid going into college next year. The kid was a 1580 SAT, 4.x grade point average. And of course, high achiever, again, emotionally. And I'm thinking, look, a high achiever, I'm going to go to an elite school. Whether or not it's the right fit or not, there's more to that planning. But again, I looked at their list and all the schools they looked at were profile and consensus schools. For those listening, that means it goes beyond FAFSA. They look at a lot more things. They look at retirement plans. They look at future income. They look at worlds of places. And so in this situation, every school they were looking at was going to be consensus. Even the state schools, which typically are FAFSA, they had somehow picked every state school on the list that is a profile school. University of Virginia, North Carolina, Michigan. It's like, congratulations. You got the, not even the trifecta, beyond it. Every school is looking at the kitchen sink. And so we looked at them and said, here's your situation. A lot of these are 100% need met schools. You're going to get 100% need met over the next 4 years. But because of the money that you currently have, you're going to have to come out of pocket 40 grand. But that's because they're looking at the money in your checking account, this, this, and this. So we went back and looked and said, so here are some options. In this circumstance, this was a client that said, well, what about annuities? I said, well, annuities aren't going to work because annuities don't count on FAFSA, but they absolutely do count on profile schools. They're going to look at those. And so it came down to it. I said, here's some other options. In the end, the one thing that they looked at that worked for them was a cash value life insurance policy, but it was one that was designed with no surrender charges. They could get all their money back out of it in year two if they wanted to. Those do exist. So what happened is they put their money into it. In that circumstance, they immediately were able to file FAFSA and profile, and they had a zero EFC for 4 years, 100% paid for college for the 4 years. It's a unique situation. Doesn't work for everybody. But in their circumstances, when we took a look at what was costing them and where they were going to have the biggest challenge from a college planning standpoint, it came down there was really only one solution that was going to fix it. It was going to go for free or pay 40 grand, you decide, per year. So it basically saved them $160,000 in college cost for a full ride. Now, for other people, there are people out there that are talking insurance in all cases. You know, that guy, solve it with insurance. Magic button, get your EFC down. I look at families every day. We're like, look, I can't get your EFC down. If anybody's telling you they're going to do all this to get your EFC down, and families come all the time going, I want a lower EFC. You're two W-2 employees. You make $350,000 a year. Unless you quit your job, that's not happening. So every case is different. And I think that's where the conversation needs to come back to. Nothing good, nothing bad. You really have to look at someone who has a process in this that's going to look at the big picture, the money you need today, the money you're going to need in the future, how much college is going to cost, where the biggest impact is going to be. But I'll tell you where it starts first and foremost, school selection. And this is where too many families, unfortunately, pick schools for emotional reasons and not logical reasons. And it ends up costing them lots more than they would have. And the outcome, unfortunately, isn't as great as they would have thought because it wasn't the right fit for the family or the kid, either academically or socially or financially. And if one of those three things is off, the results are diminished significantly.
I love this conversation about college. I think we could probably talk about this for hours. And I think we're probably going to have Doug on just as a solo, just to talk about college because there's so much here. I do want to get back a little bit to the topics from the interview too, is one of the things that comes up is there's a different appeal for different people, right? When people are looking at advisors, there's certain things that appeal to people in some ways and certain things that don't appeal to them in other ways. Megan and I were talking before the show, and you know, I think it's important to kind of understand not only what to look for in an advisor if you're choosing one, but to how to understand how you're making that decision. Because there's things that you're actively thinking, like I want this person to have A, B, C, and D. And then there's things you're subconsciously thinking, which are either positive or negative based on the person. I had this conversation with an advisor the other day. I was trying to educate them. I said, look, if you're sitting in a room with a prospect and they're talking to two other advisors, you probably have a 33% chance of getting that client because the client doesn't understand how to compare you versus these other two people. They're just guessing based on a gut feel. It's like this person feels better than somebody else. And I go back to this story about my father was an attorney. Most of my friends are attorneys. I grew up around attorneys. Attorneys coming out of my ears. If I needed legal help, I have attorneys everywhere. However, if I had to choose an attorney, I don't know how I'd go about that decision. Because while I understand attorneys and I understand a lot of things about the law, if I needed to hire somebody, what am I going to use for criteria? How do I make that decision? It's a squishy thing. Are they good or aren't they good? I don't know. I have to sit there in a trial and watch them do the trial. Like, how else do you make that decision? I don't know if they're any good. There's tons of attorneys out there. So the question is, how do I make that decision? Well, a lot of it comes down to like gut feel. Like, does this person feel like they're a good fit or not? It's not like a mathematical decision. So Megan, how should people think about that question in terms of choosing an advisor and which one's a good fit and which one's not a good fit? How should people think about that?
It's a lot like dating. You know, it's a mix of chemistry and experience. This is someone you are going to be incredibly vulnerable in front of because it relates to money. I would tell you it's also someone who ends up being a lot of times, if they do their job right, a little bit of a marriage counselor. And so what you want to understand is, one, what is their experience in the space? How many years have they worked? What does their typical client look like? I get asked that question a lot because I do work in ultra high net worth, you know, and no one ever feels that they're wealthy. But I would always explain to someone, the problem I have is I know a very distinct section of the tax code very well and a very distinct section of the wealth world very well. And then, you know, other aspects of it on regular tax returns, I'm not a whiz on the credits that most Americans get because I'm dealing with a different section of the code. So experience matters. And understanding in that experience how the team functions. Who are you going to be interacting with? Who is behind you? You know, will you be talking to different people from the team? How often, you know, do you engage as a client? And then there's the chemistry side. You actually have to like this person. This person could have all the best experience, be, you know, have the perfect pedigree. But if you don't like them, you're never going to call them for advice. And so that's a really, really delicate thing. A lot of times when I start working with clients, I work on a consulting basis because I want to make sure it's the right chemistry fit. You would not believe how many times in meetings over the years, I've seen people move 8 figures to someone and a firm just because they had one meeting with them. It astounds me because it's not the behavior I would engage in. So I think that that's really important. And I think the other thing I would say is a lot of times when I'm working with clients, my clients get asked to invest in a lot of angel investing, you know, come invest alongside us, the founders. And it is the most sexy experience. When people want you to invest in their startup, they got a good pitch. They make it seem like a lot of fun. They sell that concept which is very big in the high net worth world of access. You're getting in early. You're getting in at a lower valuation. And I've had to point out to clients who do these types of investments and then also do diversified private equity and venture capital. You know, I've asked them, I'm like, you know, it's funny because when those investments that are direct go south, these people ghost you. You go through this whole sexy seduction. And then when you're a couple of years in and the business fails, they don't pick up the phone. They're not as forthcoming as they were previously. And it's a very frustrating situation. And so a lot of times I point out to my clients, I'm like, listen, I know you're in this diversified private equity fund and there's 10 different managers and, you know, there's layers of due diligence, but I would much rather you hit a bunch of singles, doubles, and triples, get, you know, a 25% IRR. Again, just as an example, it's not guaranteed, but versus putting hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars with a startup that you've got to hope it goes for the fences. And so I really try to push them to dig past the sales pitch and dig past the excitement of saying you got to invest, you know, in the friends and family round, or you were the first investor. Everybody wants to be that guy or gal, but it's very rare to be that guy or gal. It's often not worth the risk.
Great insight, Megan. Appreciate that. So Doug, what about you? How do you think people should think about that question? You know, there's a big emotional part of the decision. Like, how should people think about it?
There's a huge emotional part of the decision. I think I covered some of that and kind of was stating before. I also like what Megan said. It's the team. And that's the other thing I forgot to mention. It's like, what's the team behind you? One person is not going to be able to do everything. And I think a lot of times there's an expectation that they're going to be excellent at all these things. Like you talked about, if you're three advisors and you're kind of competing, I've seen that race to the bottom. Like, you know, it's like, oh, let me show you a chart of how much more money we can make you. And I'll show you another chart of how much more money we can make you. And you can manipulate that any way you want in a rearview mirror. And it's definitely, unfortunately, a way that a lot of people end up selecting an advisor. Well, they're going to make me more. I always find one of the worst things that I believe people can do is when they say I'm diversified. And what do you mean by diversified? It's, well, I've got three or four advisors. Now, three or four advisors on different things is one thing. And I'm not talking about multi-billionaires there, because this is a different story. You hear about the number of advisors they have. But the way they use those advisors, and if they're using it effectively, is they're using it in a way of having multiple ideas. Like, give me your perspective. They test them. They want to break them. They want to hear things that are going to give them a different way of looking at it. It is not, I'm going to watch each of you outperform each other and see who does better. And that is unfortunately a failing process that a lot of people follow. It's like, well, you know, this advisor, I'm going to see which one of you is going to do better than the other one. We talk about this, Kirk, a lot. Listen, there are the things you can control, and there are the things you can't control. And we can't control the markets. So what happened years ago? We used to see mutual funds. You know, if people talk about, can the mutual funds meet indexes? We used to see mutual funds that would all of a sudden, like, wow, this mutual fund's really outperforming its peers. In many of those cases, why was it outperforming its peers? And in the 401k world, this is something we have to look at. It's basically style creep. It's like, well, all right, I'm trying to build logically an allocation here, or have something that's going to allow this investor to invest in this piece of the market. So if they're going to get small cap, got to get small cap. If you're going to get large cap. Well, if you don't know what you're investing in, that becomes a problem. So what used to happen is there would be funds out there or managers out there that would start outperforming. And when you start pulling back the layers, you'd see that, wow, why are they outperforming? Well, that's because this large cap value manager is holding 20% small cap growth. Excuse me? That's not value. But that's what'll happen. That can happen when you start getting into competition about returns. Because the markets do what the markets do. They are completely out of your control. Again, what I believe you have to do is you have to feel that you're going to like the person. That's number one. I mean, great point, Megan. I mean, listen, it might feel more comfortable going to a proctologist. For some people, it probably is. It's honestly, finances can be one of the most uncomfortable things for people to talk to, much more even so than physically. And in America, gosh, we know more about celebrities' sex lives than we know about their financial lives, because it is something Americans feel so incredibly private about. And I think there's some things that are changing. You know, one of the things that we work with families and multi-generational is getting communication up between the generations, because it can create real problems when the next generations aren't involved in some of these decisions. It is difficult. It is not comfortable. One of the things I try to set expectations with, and one of the questions I ask, are you going to be okay with uncomfortable conversations? And if they're not, I'm telling them, then you may not be a good fit with me. Because if you're asking me to work with you, and another question I ask is, if I see something, even if it's beyond what we are talking about, that I think is important, do you want me to bring it up? It seems simple, but you'd be surprised how many people out there are not going to be comfortable, not going to want to hear that. And if they're not, it's not going to be a good relationship. So you've got to like each other, but you've got to like each other in a way that, you know, because this is going to be about your family. This could be a, hopefully if it's well, a 10, 15, 20 year plus relationship. But you also have to be, value them, not just liking them, but respecting them in a way that you're going to listen to them. And it's going to be okay to have uncomfortable conversations. People like to joke about this all the time. Oh, yeah, it's just surrounded by yes men. What does that mean? It means that that person does not work well or want to hear from anybody that pushes back. And we have a negative connotation in our society and language for yes men, because it ultimately means they're going to tell you what you want to hear and problems are going to exacerbate. So you want to be with someone that you trust, that you like, but also that you're okay with having those consultative, real conversations that might be uncomfortable because it's going to lead you that way. So I think those are things that are important to have in a conversation with your advisor. And I think also it's really critical, again, to go back to what's the team to help you, because God forbid you get hit by a bus. There's got to be more there to that. What are you specifically doing in your tasks and how are you going to round everything out? Someone that is a financial planner is never going to be the best investment advisor. I'm sorry, you can't spend enough time doing it. There are incredible investment teams that unfortunately couldn't give you holistic financial planning to save their life. So how do those coordinate together and work with those teams? Where is that person or that consultant that you're going to be working with going to fit into this equation? Where are you going to be able to fill the gaps? And ultimately, how is that team going to support you? That process is going to support you. I think those are critical, critical things that people don't spend enough time working on, because like, oh, I like that person. Listen, people liked Madoff. It didn't work out well.
Yeah, that's a great point. And just to follow up, Doug, I'm pretty sure nothing's more uncomfortable than going to the proctologist. Just wanted to throw that out there.
At least the proctologist has anesthetic. That's all I'm going to say.
Anyway, off to a new topic. So we're going to wrap it up here on that note. Megan, final thoughts from you, and where can people find more about you?
A lot of what we talked about today is just doing your own due diligence when you go to work with an advisor or planner. And so, you know, before you start meeting with people to interview them to see if they're a fit, come up with your questions, come up with the things that you want to know so that you can compare apples to apples, you know, the answers on experience, and then really think through chemistry. It is incredibly important in these relationships. So I'm Megan Gorman. You can find me at Forbes.com/Megan Gorman. Kirk, thanks for having me on.
Thanks for coming on, Megan. And Doug, final thoughts from you.
One of the things I know that is really popular, and again, certain groups do this more than others, but social media has really exacerbated this too, is finding people through friends. Like, people like to be referred. They like to go to their friends' groups. I've seen it, you know, 401ks, you know, people's like, well, you know, I talk to the person I work with and they give me advice, and it's, you know, we call that cubicle advice, right? Just because it's good for them doesn't mean it's good for you. Go back to Madoff. How did Madoff build the client list and the incredible amount of money that he took in? It's because friends recommended, friends referred. Be very careful, even though it is good to have, and it's great to meet some people because hopefully you're in the same circle, you align a little bit. Even in the college world, one family, even though they're friends, completely different than each other, completely different kids. So it might be a good way to meet them, but don't go into those relationships thinking, well, if my friend works with you and trusts you, then I should. That's not true. Understand the questions, understand the process. Remember, make decisions logically, followed by emotion, not emotion followed by logic, because unfortunately, when you make decisions emotionally, the followed by logic never happens. So I think that's a great thing. And again, going back to what we talked about at the beginning for process, if you want to learn more about a process that can be put in place to help you and your children find the right college academically, financially, and socially, start by getting our checklist at procollegeplanners.com and learn more about our philosophy and practice there. And maybe we can help you have an extraordinary future for your children.
Great. Well, thanks for coming on, Doug. And that's the show for this week. Thank you again for joining us, the Money Tree Investing Podcast. My name is Kirk Chisholm, Wealth Manager of Innovative Advisor Group. We don't just manage your wealth, we make your life better. You can find more about me at innovativewealth.com. And of course, you can find me every week here on the show. Please remember to subscribe to the podcast and the podcast app of your choosing. You can also check out the show at moneytreepodcast.com. On our website, you'll have access to the show notes, resources, and the archive shows. Also, we're now on YouTube, so please check out our YouTube channel. When you're there, please subscribe and leave a comment. Lastly, please leave a short rating and comment on the podcast app of your choice. Oh, and don't forget, do your own research. The show is for informational use only. We're not telling you what to think, merely how to think about investing. We're also not selling any products or services, so do not consider this advice. If you have any problems with the show, I blame Putin. So please send him an email and express your feelings. If you're seeking financial advice, talk to an oracle or a fortune teller or maybe just a licensed financial advisor. I'm one, but as I said earlier, I'm not selling anything, but I'm easy to find. Have a great week ahead. And remember, no one will care about your money like you do. So invest in your life.
Thank you for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Visit us at moneytreepodcast.com for more free investing resources.